Earlier this fall, two of the country's foremost scholars on the First Amendment came to Fayetteville as part of the University of Arkansas's Hartman Hotz Lecture Series in Law and Liberal Arts. Robert Post, the dean of the Yale Law School, and Frederick Schauer, the former dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, delivered a talk on the First Amendment and academic freedom. A few hours before that discussion, they sat down inside an office at the University of Arkansas School of Law. Robert Post says the 45-word text of the First Amendment remains a major source of passionate debate and argument more than 200 years after it was written.
The amendment is very simple, but of course it applies to the freedom of speech. And everything we do is through speech. Montaigne used to say, you know, we're human, so we relate to each other through speech. So if you take that literally, it would apply to everything and anything that we do vis-a-vis other human beings, because we become human because we communicate. So the first task of thinking about the amendment is to think where it should and shouldn't apply. That's got to be task number one, is to simplify it and describe with some degree of precision the occasions when you want to bring the full force of the Constitution to bear.
And it is interesting, given the way you introduce the subject, much of the rest of the world thinks that the U.S. is obsessed with this. That is, there's certainly some form of freedom of expression or freedom of communication protection in every open democracy in the world. But the U.S.'s degree of protection is vastly greater than anywhere else in the world, including any of the other liberal democracies. Most other countries think that we come out far too heavily on the side of freedom of speech and freedom of the press at the expense of other things. The Canadians, for example, think equality is just as important, and in conflicts between speech and equality, equality ought to win more than it does. The Germans feel the same way about dignity. The French feel that way about privacy and a whole bunch of other things. So it's an important topic in the U.S., but also the importance of it in the U.S. is an important topic.
You mentioned that other countries think we're obsessed. All you have to do is turn on the 24-hour cable news cycle, and you can see that we're obsessed, whether it's Tea Party activists, Occupy Wall Street, Hank Williams Jr. You cannot go a day, it seems, without a public discussion about either freedom of speech or the importance of freedom of speech.
It is universal, and it is an interesting question how much of that comes from the fact that it's enshrined in a constitution that's now 200 and some years old, how much of that is a function of it being a formative part of the revolutionary experience, how much of it is a function of a whole bunch of other things. But it's the argument of choice. There is a, both in law and in public debate, as you mentioned, a degree of what we might call First Amendment opportunism. If you have an argument, you want to hook it onto the First Amendment, in much the same way that, again, the Canadians, if you have an argument, you want to hook it onto equality. And in other countries, you want to hook your argument onto something. The opportunism in the U.S. is that the iconic First Amendment, the iconography of free speech and free press is something that everybody wants to use, regardless of whether their arguments are intrinsically at the core of free speech ideas or not.
Yeah, I think Fred has it absolutely right. One hypothesis about why it's true in the United States that we're so obsessed with freedom of speech is speech is the political liberty par excellence. And you need a political liberty when you distrust the government. I just came from teaching in Germany, and they have a constitution, and it guarantees freedom of expression. It actually also guarantees freedom of academic freedom, and so on. But they give much less freedom of speech than in the United States, as Fred observed. But that corresponds with a much greater trust in the government. So in Europe, where you can have a good deal of your economy regulated out of Brussels with a great deal of democratic deficit, the population seems to accept that. In the United States, where we see black helicopters hovering over every distant horizon, where the government is always facing a crisis of legitimacy, where the population runs against Washington every time you have an election, you need something that ties the government to the people. And the ecology in the United States of political legitimacy is such that we appeal to the right of freedom of expression because we think by speaking we'll make the government hear us and be responsive to us, and we have a great need to do that, much more than in most countries in the world, certainly much more than in Canada, say, or Australia, or any of the European countries.
Or even more than countries who have far less reason to trust their governments than we do ours. That is, there have been some number of political scientists have done some pretty serious cross-country comparisons on trust in government. And the U.S. and occasionally Australia are always at or near the top of the list of do you distrust your government? Above, with some frequency, the Zimbabwes and the North Koreas and the like of the world. And maybe it's because of the revolutionary experience. Maybe it's because of the immigrant experience for many of us. Probably a vast majority of Americans. Our ancestors came here because they didn't like the governments where they were, so we are disproportionately populated by government distrusters and their descendants. And it's possible that the obsession with free speech and free press is merely a manifestation of an even larger distrust of government generally, as we're seeing these days with the Tea Party and the like.
It just seems counterintuitive that if we embrace freedom of speech, that we'd be high on the list of distrust of government.
We want speech because we need something to make the government answerable to us. We want speech because we distrust the government. It's a way of bringing the government into line with our wishes. If we think we can speak, then the government maybe will hear us. There's less of a need for freedom of speech if you just trust what the government is doing. You know, we don't see until very recently protests against very arcane boards of expertise like the Fed, you know, until we have an economic crisis, then suddenly it becomes political. But before that, you know, if you basically trust that the experts will do what they're doing, you don't need freedom of speech to say, listen to me, you're getting it wrong, you're not understanding what's happening on Main Street. And in most countries in the world, they regard government the way we would have regarded the Fed, say, in 1995 or something like that.
And therefore, in most countries, there's more trust in government, broadly speaking, to draw the distinctions that any form of speech regulation would require. So, for example, it would be unthinkable in the U.S. to make it to make Holocaust denial a crime. Most of Western Europe and Canada and many other countries are quite comfortable saying this is not a problem. We trust the government to decide, at least at the extreme, what's true and what's false, what are good ideas, what are harmful ideas. The ability to sanction people for going over the line is a function of trust in those who would administer the sanctions. And that trust doesn't exist here in ways that it does in other places. So in France, for example, which probably among Western European countries has the greatest degree of legal regulation of hate speech, former actress, current animal activist Brigitte Bardot has been fined and otherwise sanctioned for her anti-Islamic statements. Jean Le Pen, who the far-right politician who nevertheless is head or was head of a party that gets 15% of the vote, has been sanctioned for essentially saying that, you know, the Holocaust happened, but it wasn't that big a deal, and things of this sort that would never happen here.
So another, I think Fred is 150% accurate in what he says. Another way to see this is you have a trust in government to draw the line. So the line is you can say this, but to say that would be to go too far and to engage in hate speech or something. You have to have trust in where the line is drawn. So where does the government draw the line? Who is the government when it draws the line? So in part, because of the history of the absolute monarchies in Europe, because of the history of absolute government, democracy is a relatively recent invention. People in Europe were subjects of the state, not citizens, and so forth and so on. So you would trust the state. But even more deeply, the question would be, who's the state? And in countries like Canada and France and Germany, there are elite strata of the population. And as a social matter, there's great trust in the hegemony of certain elite stratas of the population that know what's best. In the United States, we have a free-for-all that among social strata. Populism in the United States is strong and well precisely because the lower classes refuse to know their place. They're always rising up in resentment. And if you think of a model for that constitutionally, the best example would be our Establishment Clause. So we don't allow for the establishment of religion. That wasn't because the founding generation was a religious or atheist, far from it. It was rather because we had so many different competing Protestant sects. We had Baptists and Methodists and Episcopalians and so and Congregationalists and Presbyterians. They were each afraid that the national government would come under the dominion of one or the other, so they made a treaty. They said no one sect could control the resources of the federal government. Freedom of speech is a little bit the same. Because our social classes, as well as the distrust of the state, our social classes regard each other with such distrust, we don't trust any particular class to have hegemony, and we use the First Amendment to say no class gets to draw the line, say this goes too far. This is uncivil to say this, because to say uncivil is to say my rules of civility are the one that defines who gets to be at the table.
One area in which this plays out, it goes back to what Robert was saying at the beginning about trying to figure out which forms of speech in the literal sense have something to do with the First Amendment and which ones have nothing to do with it. Much of this plays out in the degree of trust or distrust of administrative agencies. So although there are lots of people who traditionally would distrust the government to decide which political ideas are right or wrong, traditionally, we've trusted the Federal Trade Commission to decide, for example, that advertisements for diet slippers and diet earrings, I am not making this up, are so preposterously false that they can be sanctioned. The Food and Drug Administration, in its labeling requirements, does much the same thing. The Securities and Exchange Commission does much the same thing in requiring registration before you sell securities. I wonder whether in the recent last 3 or 4 years, even more extreme anti-government sentiment, whether this is spilling over into a sentiment in opposition to even expert administrative agencies. The Federal Reserve used to be in that esteem and no longer is. And whether at some point, at least some people will worry that the Securities and Exchange Commission, the FTC, the FDA, and the like can't be trusted to decide what's true and what's false, even in the realm of fact and even in the realm of science.
Just to build on what Fred is saying, this distrust of government expertise, agency expertise, is, of course, built into the right wing of the Republican Party. And we now have many justices on the U.S. Supreme Court who come out of that wing of the party. And it's quite apparent that they're increasing First Amendment protections for commercial speech because they don't trust the expert judgments of the agencies. And they imagine striking down regulations of deceptive speech or regulations of commercial interactions, which, of course, all occur through speech. They imagine that as part of a libertarian agenda of reducing government regulation altogether. And one of the reasons that they pursue this agenda is because they don't trust in the neutral expertise of government.
So Robert touches on one of the most fascinating dimensions of the free speech culture in the last 10 to 15 years, a huge change in its political incidence. When people of our age were coming of academic or legal age, free speech was the argument on behalf of communists, socialists, anti-Vietnam War protesters,
civil pornographers,
civil rights demonstrators, and so on. It was, by and large, the argument of the left. More recently, all of the things that Robert was talking about regulation of commercial advertising, combined with opposition to so-called political correctness, combined with opposition to the feminist anti-pornography movement, combined with perhaps most saliently the debates about campaign finance regulation. Increasingly, there's been a huge shift, and that as often, if not more, the strong free speech position is on what might loosely be called the political right rather than the political left.
Robert Post, the dean of the Yale Law School, and Frederick Schauer, the former dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, visited the University of Arkansas campus this fall.
Their public discussion involved academic freedom and the First Amendment, and they discussed that topic before their public lecture as well. We'll hear that and more ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. We continue now with our conversation with Robert Post and Frederick Schauer, recorded at the University of Arkansas School of Law, when both men were here late last month to discuss the First Amendment and academic freedom as part of the Hartman Hotz Lecture Series in Law and Liberal Arts at the University of Arkansas. Earlier in the conversation, the men had used the example of Holocaust deniers and freedom in other countries. I return to that example for the next part of our discussion.
If I wanted to deny the Holocaust, and I went down to the corner here, and I could do that, I would get strange looks, perhaps a fist to the nose, but I could do that. If I go back to the public radio station I work for and do that, I'd have the pink slip in my hand within an hour. If I'm a professor on a campus, can I do that?
When we're talking about speech, typically in the United States, and the protection of speech, we're talking about speech which is part of the formation of public opinion. It's extreme. A democracy is a form of government in which the government, the state, is answerable to public opinion. And the forms of speech acts which create public opinion are typically the ones that the First Amendment, when you think of a paradigmatic First Amendment case, protects. And it's a very complicated thing, what public opinion is as opposed to private opinion. But however you think about that issue, the boundary issue, what we do is we discuss what to do in public. There's a public opinion. The state responds to public opinion by trying to do something. It makes a decision. It wants to create a Social Security Administration or something else. So in order to accomplish a goal in the modern world, you have to create an organization. An organization is an arrangement of people and resources dedicated to a mission, to an objective. Hand out Social Security checks, or defend the country in the military, or dispense justice with the courts. Organizations are purposely defined. They're subject to means ends or instrumental reasoning. Right? When you govern in an organization, you have to arrange people and resources to accomplish the goal of the mission. That means you have to be able to regulate their speech so as to accomplish the mission of the organization. So if I'm in the Social Security Administration and my subordinate is supposed to be handing out checks and instead decides to stand on his desk and make a speech, whether it's denying the hall or anything, it's just not doing their job, that's a problem, right? So within these governmental organizations, the regulation of speech looks and feels completely different than it does than when you stand on the corner and deny the Holocaust. Because when you're standing on the corner, you're addressing the public, which is to say strangers, people you don't know, and it's presumably an effort to change public opinion. But when you're working in your job is to do whatever the mission is of public radio, and they can regulate your speech so as to attain their job, whatever that is. And that gets into another set of questions.
And if I – so what – in technical terms for First Amendment specialists is called content regulation or viewpoint regulation, pervades our jobs. I can go out, and any of my students can go out on the street and say, in my opinion, the Constitution of the United States has 39 amendments and was first adopted in 1883 as part of a communist conspiracy. They can say all of that. If they put that on one of my exams, I, as an official of the Commonwealth of Virginia, am going to sanction them for it. So, too, when, at least in the context of state universities, like here, like mine, that We routinely make tenure and promotion decisions about our colleagues. We take into account not only the content of what they write, but to put it bluntly, the truth and falsity of what they write. And we can't imagine that it would be otherwise. Balancing that line, being able to say to my junior colleagues, we want you to go where your mind takes you, but at some point, we're going to evaluate you on whether your mind has taken you to places that are either ridiculous or even unoriginal, and that will hurt you.
Right. So, I mean, to take this to the subject of academic freedom is the freedom that applies to, say, professors at a university. And often, if Fred or I would ask our colleagues, what's your academic freedom, the answer would be it's the First Amendment right. But what Fred just said demonstrates, I think, that it's completely incompatible with the First Amendment right. A First Amendment right is the right to assert your opinion, which is why we say in the First Amendment there's no such thing as a false idea. The state can't judge the truth or falsity of your opinions when you're trying to shape public opinion. But that's precisely opinion. When you're in an organization like the university and your job is to create knowledge or to communicate knowledge, you are judged by your competence at that mission. And competence is not just a matter of having an opinion. It's a matter of having a competent opinion. And throughout universities, we judge people on their competence, the competencies of their opinion. So you have somebody who's an astronomer, and he writes an editorial in the New York Times, says, I've just made this great discovery. The moon is made of green cheese. Nothing happens. But he wants to get tenure based on that, doesn't get tenure. So the right of academic freedom is the right not to be able to say your opinion, which is a First Amendment right, an individual right, a subjective right. The right of academic freedom is the right to be judged on your competency and not by criteria which are irrelevant to your competency, like my academic judgment that evolution is actually a scientific fact happens to offend the people of the state of Arkansas who believe in creationism. The belief, the popular belief, can't be used to judge the competency of my expert opinion about evolution. That's the essence of academic freedom.
Do you have a gauge of the quotient, the First Amendment quotient of either the American public or the American press? Well, how much we know, how much we are knowledgeable? Because we all have a gut feeling. We can all yell about it.
There are two very different issues here. Let me take the, very briefly in reverse order. It's interesting that you mentioned the press. Of course, the press is hardly a disinterested observer of controversies about free speech and free press. And therefore, in many areas, the press makes free press and free speech claims that are even more aggressive than existing doctrine would say. Many of the claims, for example, about reporters' privileges, which are important claims, go considerably beyond where even American law is now. So I don't think there's a little bit of a knowledge problem with respect to the press, but it's more of a advocacy position that the press has. With respect to the public, there's a lot of abstract support for free speech. There's very little support, and lots of surveys have reported this, for speech of things that are in particular wrong, perceived to be wrong, or perceived to be dangerous. I'll give one example. Back in the late 1980s, the Supreme Court, in a case called Texas versus Johnson, upheld the right of a man named Gregory Lee Johnson to burn the American flag. And for at least the majority of the Supreme Court, this was not a particularly difficult case. Almost immediately thereafter, Congress, which has a much better sense of the feelings of the American public than I do, passed a law almost identical to the one that the Supreme Court had struck down by a vote of more or less 460-30, or between the two houses, something like that. The Supreme Court then struck that one down a year later. But the flag burning controversy is a reasonably good indication of the fact that once we are talking about speech that is perceived to be or is extreme, dangerous, dead wrong, or whatever, the courts are way, way out ahead of where the American public has been or will ever be.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, if you look at the history of free speech doctrine, It used to be, up until 1964, that the press always wanted to go to a jury. I mean, the great history of liberty of press from Fox's Libel Act in the 18th century is we want to take it away from the executive, from judges, and we want to give it to the people because they will understand freedom of press. And freedom of press was understood as the liberty of the people vis-a-vis the state, vis-a-vis the king, vis-a-vis the judges, etc. At the beginning of our modern era of First Amendment doctrine is a case called New York Times versus Sullivan. And it basically said, I will have liberty to defame you, which means to say nasty things about you that will reduce the esteem in which you are held in your community. And for most people, it's very counterintuitive that people should be able to talk in ways like that, which are quite damaging to people's reputation and to your sense of self. And yet the court said, if we're going to have free public discourse, we can't be guided by the community norm of what is damaging and what's civil and what's not civil. So the sociological formation of the public overrode the community norms by which you and I live most of our lives. It's actually quite naked and exposed to be out in public where we're stripped of the normal protections that we have among our friends, among the community of people who share our norms and so on, who have the tacit understandings that we understand as respect and dignity and so forth. In the public, people just get to talk about you. And it's, you know, if you've ever been there, if you've ever been exposed to public comment, it's extremely vulnerable making. So ever since that moment, from 1964 on, the press is always seeking to get the decision by a judge who's an expert in this First Amendment law rather than the jury, because the jury will hang them. Because the jury is enforcing local norms, which are how most Americans. Now, that's been, I would say, the dynamic now for 50 years. Yeah. But it's also the case that if you ask the American public, they demand and they sit on their First Amendment rights. They just don't have much of a clue of what it is.
Especially since a disproportionate number of the most prominent claimants of free speech cases have been pretty distasteful people. So we have the Klan, we have the Nazis, we have flag burners.
Crusher movie makers.
We have makers of animal cruelty. Crush movie.
Larry Flint.
We have Larry Flint, we have child pornographers. The most of the prominent claimants of free speech rights, and most of the people who have been formative in creating this exceptional American tradition have been pretty distasteful people with pretty distasteful things to say. And there's a real question whether that ever would have happened without, as Robert said, essentially the courts being at the forefront of this.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.